Following interview with MEA General Manager Joe Griffith was recorded on the morning show on April 16th, 2013, in the studios of KVRF-FM in downtown Palmer. Did you want to make any comment about kicking off with this recent possibility of coming up with a gas supply through the first couple of years of the Eklutna plant operation?
Well, the beauty of what we have been told, it all started with interest from the state's attorney general, who went to both Marathon and Hillcorp and said, we've got potential problems here with this sale. Let's work up a deal. And that's what they crafted, was a five-year deal. Judge approved that in January, and then that allowed Hillcorp and Marathon to consummate the deal that they had worked up. And having worked with the Hillcorp folks before, and I'm confident that they're about as good as you can get.
Okay.
And they have a shorter-term view, I think, than do the big guys like Marathon and Conoco, and I believe that's good for all of us.
One of the obvious near-term events happening is the upcoming election, and there's one contested seat. The two others are uncontested, and we were privileged to stream the forum that recently happened last week where people had a chance to talk about things. And I know that the two topics that came up involved first the Eklutna power plant, how that's coming along, and then secondly, the movement, the questions about how to move power from Eklutna into the valley. Let's take the first one, the Eklutna power plant. I know that there'd been some long discussion about where to put this thing, and apparently, you know, the decision was made based upon the best information available at the time, and there it is. It's coming along apparently on schedule, and we'll be opening up by 1 January 2015.
That's our target date, okay. And right now we can make that.
Okay, that sounds good. I know I've been able to sit in on some presentations that covered in particular the equipment that's going to be in that power plant, because there's some very interesting design features on the generators themselves.
They are beautiful machines. They look like a wristwatch.
Oh yeah, that's amazing. As you look at this at the present time, it sounds like that part of the thing is in place. One of the questions that came up with is, and this is ranging into the hypothetical, if that plant were located elsewhere in the valley, would that mean that there would be an easier task in finding the line path to move power?
I don't think so. The transmission system out here in the valley has been weak for many, many years.
Okay.
There's literally one single transmission line that comes from the south side of the Kinnick Arm around to Palmer Sub and eventually to Lucas Sub right here in Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
That power has to be delivered to the main load center that's 10 miles west of here.
Okay.
And we don't have much of a transmission system built. And the former management of MEA wasn't in the slightest bit inclined to build transmission.
Okay.
So what I'm having to do now is to fix 15 or 20 years of neglect of the transmission system. So irrespective of where we had placed the plant, mm-hmm. we would still be having to put transmission lines to carry the bulk power around.
Okay. Okay. What is this a smaller version of what is the situation statewide as far as transmission lines?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Okay. Same situation. There is inadequate transmission in the whole rail belt between Fairbanks and Homer, and we have to fix that. And unfortunately, this legislature chose to take all of those programs out of the budget. So right now we're dead in the water again. And without some help on the transmission side, the impacts will be heavy, both to our pocketbook and to other projects that are downstream like Wautana. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to sign up for the Wautana project if we don't have transmission to deliver it.
Okay. And that's been, you know, that's been a concern. I know many people, and you've worked heavily, as I remember, attempting to bring together the power utilities in the state in order to coordinate and be able to push for support from the legislature and make that happen. It's a curious thing. Is there any sense that you can share about why that isn't one of those basic, obvious things to be supported?
It baffles me. It really does, because it's so important infrastructure, and the utilities have really no ability to handle it themselves. It's too big. It's like asking a citizens group to build highways and ports and airports. They're not going to ever do that. They can't afford it. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem with the support of the electrical system in the rail belt. It's weak. It has been forever. Bradley Lake was never finished. The project was curtailed, and we ended up with inadequate transmission capability for that project. For 25 years, we made it work, but we have run out of gas on that. We've got to do something different, and particularly if you put a large plant like Wautauna, 150 miles north of here, then you've got to have a good transmission system to get it out. Otherwise, you're wasting your time.
Okay. Now, we're here with Joe Griffith, MEA General Manager, and it's the top of the hour, KVRF Sutton, 89.5 on your FM dial. We're going to continue on with this discussion of MEA and a number of the features of the future development of power here in this area. I'm curious, Joe, The paper headlines have been all about the transmission lines and choosing a route, moving power from a Clutna, and as you're saying, dealing with an infrastructure that has long needed improvement. There's been some discussion about the process, and I know that you are involved with both the city and perhaps the borough and other entities, regulatory agencies, about how to do that. How would you characterize the situation at the present time? How's that process going? Is it following along pretty much as you had envisioned it some time ago, or do you see some I don't want to put words in your mouth here.
Well, I had the experience of helping put together the transmission line down East Northern Lights in Anchorage. The big 138 lines, and that took 10 years to do that. So am I surprised that we're getting pushback? Not at all.
Okay.
And citizens don't like transmission lines in their backyard. So you've got to find that sweet spot that satisfies the need of the electrical system as well as what your customers and your members need to have. No, it's been a challenge. We knew it was going to be a challenge. I underestimated a little bit the pushback from the Wasilla folks, but right now we've gone through all of the necessary hoops. Mm-hmm. We're following the law in all cases. We have four separate routes we're looking at, and I've made an offer to Wasilla. I'll put it wherever you want, but you have to help me pay for it. I can't saddle 58,000, 53,000 other members with your costs. Mm-hmm. I haven't got an answer back to that one yet.
Okay, there was some mention in the article that I read today in the Frontiersman about the possibility of doing it in a way that would, if, for example, the choice was to bury a portion of the transmission line, that the people along that path that were going to benefit from a buried line would pay a portion of that that cost. That happened in other places?
Yes, it has. We, in fact, worked a deal in but those were not transmission lines. They were distribution lines. But And South Anchorage and Eagle River both have surcharges that pays for undergrounding the distribution system. And every year we put $1 million or $1.5 million into undergrounding the Eagle River area. I don't like to underground transmission systems. They're dangerous. Secondly, they cost a heck of a lot of money to do. And thirdly, they're extremely difficult to maintain if something goes wrong. You got to find where the problem is and dig it up, and they're usually in concrete chaises.
Right.
The cables are 6 inches in diameter, so this is heavy work, and I don't like to do it, but I will do it if Wausau is willing to pay for it.
Because I think you've nicely described the situation, because very often I have heard people say, well, just put them underground, not taking into consideration the issues that you have described here with maintenance.
Maintenance is a real problem. You can imagine the chaises all fill with water, mm-hmm. and then it freezes.
Oh.
and then so does the ground, too.
The ground does, and you have to thaw it, and it takes days to thaw it. And meantime, you have to have alternate routes to get the power to the load centers. So that's one reason we're fixing the transmission system, is try to have alternate routes to a good deal of the big substations.
Okay. Well, switching to a slightly different topic, it sounds, or going back to this reference about finding a gas supply, we know that from what you've said that it looks good for the near future. And we know that there's been a lot of discussion about ultimately how to bring gas on down from the north into this area or to find other sources in the Cook Inlet region. One of the options which seems to have gotten some support in the legislature in this last session has to do with trucking gas down from the North Slope. And you're sitting next to a guy, Dan Grota, who has experience having been involved with trucks in Iraq and moving things. And leading up to your arrival, he was going through some of the logistical issues associated with driving.
It would be a nightmare, at least in my opinion.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. It's the folks who are appropriating the money to this project have no idea what they're really the difficulties of making that happen. The first thing that you got to do is you got to have a source of gas. So they claim they got a source of gas on the North Slope. It doesn't belong to the state. It belongs to the people, the leaseholders. Secondly, you got to have a clean source of gas that you can liquefy. Mm-hmm. Right now, they don't have that. They don't have a processing plant that can make that gas. So that's probably a $1 billion effort. They have no facilities whatsoever to liquefy it as yet, although we know how to do that, mm-hmm. if the money's there. And then you've got to have a fleet of – to get it down here, I figured out it would take about 400 trucks to do that 24/7. So, you know, he's talking a fleet of vehicles, and in the winter they would all be piled up at the bottom of Attigan Pass. So I don't think you could pull it off.
On an unimproved road that's
– Yes.
Dirt roads that are turned into ice.
Slick.
Real slick. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. Just from the maintenance point of view of just keeping those rigs up.
That was my estimation. It's going to be really, really tough. But let's face it, Fairbanks has a huge problem.
Right.
And that's our second largest city, and we have to do something to fix it. Mm-hmm. So at least the people are concerned enough to say we're going to try to do something to help them out.
Well, I know that for many years there have been discussions, and it appears there have been too many options almost, and that there, what kind of line would be required to bring a pipeline that brings the gas on down? And that also received some support from the governor in particular as being a small diameter line to make that happen. Any sense that you have of what are the major obstacles, other than this is a big project, to actually getting a line from the slope down at least to Fairbanks, if not all the way down to the lower 48?
Well, it's a huge undertaking and very costly, but it's the kind of infrastructure that we actually talked about 34 years ago, I believe, in a program called the ANCST, Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Mm-hmm. system, or something of that ilk. And we thought it was going to happen then. And we've tried several times since, and we still haven't got there, although this year they at least put some more money into the so-called bullet line. You can go with a 24-inch line would handle all of our needs. Part of the problem today is the AGEA program and its limit of 500 million a day. that is a huge limiting factor, and we have to figure out how to get around that. And you need a bigger market than just the utilities.
Okay. Okay. That's understandable. Well, switching from those sort of practical aspects of power, the plant, transmission lines, getting the fuel, et cetera, what we I've suggested been in the business for a long time, and you're working with a board of directors here at MEA. How would you characterize your relationship? I know there are different models of governance. People talk about a Carver model or this model or that model. Is there a way you'd summarize how you relate to the board here at MEA?
Yeah, I have what I think is a very good working relationship with my board. And that doesn't mean they agree with everything I say or that I agree with everything that they say. But mm-hmm. I try to work with them collectively and individually, so that they understand what I'm doing and why we're trying to do the things we are.
Okay.
And I want to understand their points of view. When it gets difficult is when politics bleeds over into it, and that always isn't the same objective that a management of a utility has. But so far, knock on wood, I've been able to deal with it.
Okay. Well, and that seems to be, at least from, I think, the public's perception, I'm noticing that many people have been commenting that MEA is, with differences of opinion about particular decisions, but generally speaking, that MEA seems to be moving along and dealing with issues, and that's a good thing. I had two questions that I was particularly interested in having you address. One has to do with this whole concept of being a co-op. You know, we here at the radio station are a member, and my wife and I in our home are members as well. The whole concept of being a co-op is a kind of an interesting thing. How would you encourage people who are members to participate in this cooperative endeavor? I mean, is there some specific things that we should be doing, or you think would make the whole thing better?
Well, co-ops are different than for-profit entities, certainly. And for-profit entities, you have shareholders, and they technically own the company. In the co-ops, it's the membership owns the company, but they seldom get any return from it. The benefit is it's a cheaper way of doing business. They were originally created to support the REA program, the federal program that electrified the rural areas of the country. Today, we operate on less rate of return by far than the for-profit entities do, so it's the cheapest way to do it. Mm-hmm. How do you get involved? You read our newsletters, you read our articles, and if you have problems, you call our people that are there to handle it and talk to them. Okay. And it's every day we have customers and members come in, and not just to pay their bills, but to talk about their electrical systems and the problems they're having. Many of them today are having difficulty paying, and we have workout programs. The big for-profit entities wouldn't do that. They would tell you pay up or the lights go off. And we try not to do that. We truly take our members' interests at heart and recognize that they're the people that we're here for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sounds like a nice model. It's certainly been around.
I think it's good. It's been around now for 75 years. And, in fact, most people don't realize, but about 30% of the United States economy is in co-ops, the farm-to-market co-ops, and the fruit growers, the nut growers, the cranberry people, those are all co-ops, and they quietly make it work for the people who are their members.
Okay. Now, in the state of Alaska, when we look at other power companies, are most, I realize, I don't know, are how many power co-ops do we have in Alaska?
Or? Most of them in Alaska are co-ops or municipal owned. You've got Municipal Light and Power is owned by Anchorage. And Juno, AEL&P in Juno, is a for-profit. And there's one other for-profit, I believe, at Toke.
Okay.
And all the rest of us are either government-owned or co-ops.
Okay. All right. So now you've been here. How many years have you been at MEA?
This is coming up on my fourth year.
Fourth year, okay. Looking over that time, what would you say has been the thing that you can look back and say, you know, this was a good thing that I've been involved with and has happened under my four-year watch?
I'm pleased with the way things have gone. We've turned MEA in the last 4 years into a modern, effective business organization that has a genuine concern for its people and its product, and I'm very pleased with that. The biggest challenge has been fixing the transmission system and building the plant. That's no small undertaking for a little backwoods distribution co-op that had 135 people when I came here. Soon we will be a world-class producer of electricity, transmitting, distributing it. That's a big change in a short period of time.
Well, I understand that. Many people have commented that MEA's done its job distributing power, but now you're moving, and maybe some listeners don't fully appreciate what that means to move to be a producer in addition to being a transmitter of power.
That means you're the last resort for everything. If something goes wrong, it's they know who made it happen, and it's a challenge. It's expensive, and you've got all the problems associated with ensuring that you can provide the services that people need and want.
Okay. Dan, do you have any questions for Joe here?
Yeah, a couple. I've been reading about lately about some alternative means of generating power, such as tidal and wind power, like the Fire Island project going on. Considering the growth of the valley, is there any possibility of having, like, say, a wind power generation farm here in the valley to help provide power for the railboat as well as Palmer and Wasilla?
I don't know how good the wind is in the valley. The wind is fickle, as you know. It
yes.
blows hard for a while, and then it's a day like today when it doesn't blow at all. Fire Island had a pretty steady wind, and the reason I can tell you that is it was my project to start with at Chugach.
Wow.
It was one of my guys in the power generation sector that I put on finding the wind sites. We found about four that were really good, and they were all down the Turnagain Arm. We looked at a couple areas up here, but they weren't very good.
Ah.
Eva Creek up north of Healy that Golden Valley has put in is a good source, and Fire Island is pretty good. Whatever wind you put in, you've got to back it up with gas turbines or recip engines.
Yeah,
because wind is fickle.
Mm-hmm. You have to have some way of switching.
Unless you're at a place like, the
Tehachapi Pass, maybe, in
right.
California.
Yeah.
Apparently that's pretty good.
Well, I was impressed out in Kodiak because, of course, they have not only the wind generation at the top, but they have hydro as well.
And if you can make that coordination between wind and hydro, then that helps a lot. And that's what they do. They'll back their hydro down as the wind comes up and vice versa.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we would do if we had the transmission system in the rail belt and Wautana. We would balance Wautana water flows and output with Bradley Lake down by Homer.
Wow.
But the infrastructure has to be built before
the infrastructure's got to be there. Yes, it does.
That seems to be the biggest thing I've been hearing about. I've only been here in Alaska since 2005, but the biggest thing I've been hearing about is you have to build the infrastructure. The state doesn't have it.
That's right.
And you have to start from scratch, whereas down south in the lower 48, they've had that infrastructure for close to 100 years.
That's correct. They really have. Since 125 years, they've been building electrical systems down there. We really didn't get started till the mid-80s up here.
Wow.
We built each of these little enclaves, balkanized systems, and that has created some of the turf issues that the utilities have faced for years, was the way they started.
I see.
We finally hooked them together when the Alaska Energy Authority built the intertie from Willow to Healy. That finally tied us all together. That was 1984-85.
Mm-hmm. At the current rates right now, if this doesn't go through or the transmission lines are still delayed by politics, could MEA handle the power load?
We will be able to handle our own, and there are ways. We're connected with both Chugach and MLNP, and if we can't get Bradley Lake delivered, and it's going to be a problem because of the way the system is now configured. If we don't fix the transmission side of it, we can still supply our area very comfortably.
I see.
So I have a question, Joe, that looks out into the future, into the fantasy world. Long time ago, I became interested in Buckminster Fuller's ideas, and now you're smiling. And he had a number of interesting ones, and one of them was utilizing what he referred to as the Demaxian map, which showed how actually if you ran a transmission line up through Alaska and across the straits, you could connect all the land masses and deliver power all around the world. It one important thing that had to be achieved, and that was superconducting transmission of power. I know there's been some work done on that. There are groups that have been involved in it. Do you have any sense that is ever going to be into the future?
It's certainly feasible, and today the technology could support it. You could use high-voltage DC transmission lines today and probably make it happen. Uh-huh. Losses would be reasonable. But what you would gain, of course, would be that the sun's on the other side of the world, and you can move power back and forth. Part of the problem is you'd have to accommodate 50 cycle on one side and 60 cycle or 60 hertz on our side. Today, that's doable. We know how to handle that. And the terrible cost of it is what I think keeps people from even thinking about it.
Okay.
There may come a time that we would want to do something like that. But frankly, I believe that these small nuclear plants will be more user-friendly and less expensive in the long run than trying to string wires all over the world.
Okay. When we talk about small, I was just recently down in Florida, and in the Crystal River area, there was a large nuclear plant that just recently been closed down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, do you see smaller units in the near future, perhaps even in Alaska?
I think it'll be a long time before we ever get a nuclear facility up here. But the so-called nuclear battery technology has come a long way in the last 10 years. Today, you could have probably a 50-megawatt unit, bring it in literally on trucks, dig a hole, put it in, and 30 years later, you come in and pull it out and put another one in. They have a couple of demonstration capabilities of that today. But again, there's a lot of resistance to two things in the electrical power industry, coal and nuclear.
Right.
Especially fission reactors.
Oh, yeah.
If they ever perfect a fusion reactor.
In fusion, you put it in your glass water jug there.
Uh-huh.
But we haven't achieved that yet.
Yeah. Got to that. Okay, well, that's way into the future. Right now, We're focused on getting this plant operational, the transmission lines built, source of fuel there, and continuing to have people, it sounds like, pay attention, because this is a co-op. I still come back to that. It's not the kind of thing that you just sort of say, well, they're taking care of it, they're doing it. We don't have to think about it, because whether it's an election coming up here, or as you're saying, on a day-to-day basis, if you have something that you wonder about, you know, my experience personally has been that when we were setting up our two transmission sites, it was a joy to be able to go in and talk to people, engineers, about it, and say, okay. Because one of those sites did not have power to it, and mm-hmm. we had to talk about how to get the power there, how to coordinate it with the phone company as well, and the rest of it. And it was a very positive experience. I mean, I came away, and obviously we're transmitting, and it's working. But it's always about can I sit down and come to you, because I'm not an expert in this area, and have a discussion that results in my understanding and the thing being built and operating. So,
well, that's our hope, that we can ensure that happens, and that our membership can get the service they need from our people. And I demand that from my own folks.
Okay.
And frankly, I think they're providing it.
Okay. So any last comments, Joe, before we finish up?
Well, I do appreciate you having me on and the work you guys do. And remember, got an annual meeting coming up, 23rd, I believe it is.
Yes, it is.
And everybody should vote. That's how you can let your desires be known, is to vote. And you can vote electrically, or you can vote by paper, or you can vote the night of the annual meeting. So it's
all kinds of choices, and that's a good thing.
And get involved. Yeah. Come down and learn what your utility is doing.
Yeah, those meetings are a favorite place for me. I must say that there's a series of meetings, whether it's the fair, the telephone co-op. It's an opportunity to see a lot of people, talk with people, and get those kind of answers. So, yeah, I'll be there. Well, thank you, Joe Griffith, MEA General Manager.